Welcome to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast, where we discuss the world of IT and cybersecurity. Don't be left in the dark about what's going on in the world around you. Here is your host, Joe Gray.
Hi, I'm Joe Gray here with Georgia Viedman. Georgia is the CTO of Bulb Security. She is a penetration tester, researcher, trainer, entrepreneur, security guru. She received a grant from DARPA for smartphone security research. She has spoken at various conferences. She graduated college at age 18, and she authored the book Penetration Testing, A Hands-On Introduction to Hacking. Hi, Georgia.
Hi, I heard you had to look at the title. I totally heard the book shifting. Like, what's the name of the book? What's the name of the book?
It's all about respect. I didn't want to misquote it.
That's all right. Like, I had a, it's a little known fact that me and the publisher basically fought about the title for months. Like, I said the word hacking or hacker had to be in it, and they said word penetration testing had to be in it, so we put both in, so it's both penetration testing and hacking.
Aha. Yeah, I knew the actual title. It was the subtitle, the A Hands-On Introduction to Hacking, that I did not want to mess up. Full disclosure.
No worries, I'm just joking with you.
It's all good. So give us a brief overview of yourself, your business interests, your expertise.
Well, I guess I'm what you'd call the technical person through and through. When I first started work, it was you start off as a technical person and then you become a manager. And I'm not great with people, so I wasn't excited about that. I never really wanted to become a manager. I wanted to skip all those steps and like become the, you know, the person with the crown at the top who's on the news and the technical person, but not all those steps in the middle. So I guess that's how I ended up doing what I was doing. Like, about the time that it was time for me to become a manager, I quit working and started doing my own thing, but basically because I was forced to, because I got a research grant and then got fired. So, you know, that happens. So, you know, I do penetration testing, I do research, I do some development. I would not call myself a developer per se, but you know, I get the code working well enough, and when we don't have for real developers. So yeah, I have two companies now. I still have Bulb Security, my consulting LLC that I've had since I got my DARPA grant in 2012, and I also have Shavira, which I started about a year ago, and I went through the Mach 37 accelerator with it. So we're doing security products. So security consulting is nice and all, it's good business, I'll certainly never get out of it, but security products, like, you can make money while you're asleep, whereas with, like, training or pen testing or something like that, you know, you need people doing services, so someone has to actually be working. With a good product that sells well and meets people's needs, you can, you know, have developers working on new features on the product and things, but by and large, it can sell itself at a certain extent. So we're trying that out. You know, I built hacking tools for a while. So this is kind of the next iteration of that, make it a little more, you know, business centric as opposed to researcher centric, you know, slap some fancy APIs and front ends on it and make the reporting nicer, and you've got an enterprise security tool. So that's my current, like, trying to do that thing.
That almost sounds like you've plagiarized something from Advanced Persistent Security.
Really? I have to admit I haven't watched it before, so.
It's all good. We're actually working on a security product. It will actually kind of fit into the unified threat management arena. We refuse to use terminology like threat intelligence, but it is kind of a small business solution for unified threat management. Not really going to go much further on that one because we've got a lot of development to go, and I don't want to say that it can do something that it may not be able to do by the time we get to production with it.
But that's like the whole point. You have to say that your tool does everything, and then deliver any of it. That's how you make a security tool, right?
Well, I mean, we might slap the title of next gen on it, so it can be a next generation unified threat management system, or we might even say the generation after next.
What is the generation unified after next, I wonder?
I don't know. That's what we're going to call our stuff, though.
Well, I mean, I've always been, I don't know if flabbergasted is the right word, but, like, you know, when that happened with Norse, and it's like, but they were at all the conferences and they were giving out funny hats. They had to have been legit, right? I mean, that's what makes a legit company, having good swag and good boots, right? I mean, the idea
right.
that
well,
you
I
could
mean
be made up, basically, and doing that well, and, like, have people, venture capital, like, being poured into you, that it's
right.
just, since, you know, I'm in the stage of, you know, an early stage company, you know, trying to get traction and trying to get, you know, money and all that stuff, it's just, like, the idea that people can basically just make it up and succeed at it is, it's interesting. Maybe not necessarily a good way, but...
Exactly. And because we're trying to cater to small to mid-sized business, that's why we're trying to stay as honest as possible and not try to overhype anything. We would prefer the product to actually speak for itself. While you're talking about swag, you're definitely right in the swag arena. I scored this at Great Wide Open. It's a Tux the Penguin with Microsoft's Open Cloud logo on it. And then, you know, more swag from the conference as well. That's another thing we've not really developed for the company yet. I honestly don't think we're ever going to come up with swag. We'll probably just stick with business cards and maybe t-shirts and call it good.
Well, we had to do, like, we did an ISSA conference, so it was like the day after DerbyCon, which was funny because I said I'd never go back to DerbyCon, but then I went to a conference the next day in the same city, so it was basically like going to DerbyCon. And anyway, so they gave, as part of, like, my honorarium for it, they gave me a free booth, and I was like, oh, crap, now I'm going to have to, like, stock a booth. So my mom actually got pretty into it, like, making the banners and stuff, but we just had, like, the little, like, you know, those plastic bracelets that said Bulb Security and Shavira, and we had stickers, and we had one other thing that was really cool, and I can't remember what it was, but I remember that, like, the Trusted Sec booth had, like, the exact same stuff, which was funny. But yeah, we had, I guess, pretty good stuff for a small conference. But yeah, like, Norris always had the best stuff with those hats, and then when they had those boost babes that were, like, they had the girls and the boys, so it's like they did the booth babe thing right, that they kind of made fun of it, that it was like, oh, everybody just has scantily clad girls, so we'll get, like, bodybuilder dudes in, like, scantily clad gladiator outfits. I mean, I thought that was awesome. So, yeah, they did it right.
I think it sounds as if they did. Truth be told, I've never even really been to a conference. I've been to a few meetings at Hack RVA in Richmond, Virginia. I've been to a couple of ISC Squared chapter meetings, and I've been to one ISSA meeting, but I'm actually working on getting some speakers for the Atlanta ISSA conference this year. I'm planning on hitting a lot of conferences this year. Besides that, I've been to SANS training, not even the conferences.
I've never been to a SANS training. It's like, I guess I wanted to, but, you know, they were so expensive, and it was like I never had anybody to pay for it. Like, I never had an employer who was going to send me to, like, either Black Hat training or SANS training. I was like, forget it.
Exactly. I had one that was going to pay for me to go to Hacker Halted, but then the contract got cut, and I moved, so I didn't get to go to Hacker Halted. But it's going to be in Atlanta this year, so I'm probably going. I got to go to SANS training this year to renew the SANS training from 4 years ago, because when I worked for the DOD, I had to be certified as an auditor, and management sent me to SANS training for GSNA as opposed to CISA. So that's how I got in.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I do training, and I've always kind of just, like, done conference training, and for a while I did training online, like, to set up a GoToMeeting, so it's always just kind of been, like, fly-by-night kind of training, and I You know, now that I have business people around me who are, like, actually talking about, well, let's get, like, certified by the government and stuff, and then students will have to come. And I'm like, I knew there was a reason I hired you business people. So smart. So, yeah, training is an interesting thing, and that's actually, like, my CEO, you know, he's been around for forever, and, like, he remembers, like, when SANS, like, first came into being, and it's like, there's no way you'll get that many people who want to take security classes. Like, that's how long ago it was that, like, you know, security was kind of this thing, and now it's like, everybody needs security. I imagine right. The founders, at least, have made good money on that organization. So.
They're probably living pretty comfortably.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's discuss some current events. And by current events in plural, I'm realistically meaning current event in singular, because the main topic that we're covering today is a current event as well. So the big current event I have would be Apple discontinuing the use of QuickTime on Windows machines, very similar to how they handled Safari. It's like overnight they just made a decision, we are no longer supporting QuickTime on Windows. It's a gaping wide security hole. It's very high CVSS. It's a critical finding. We're still going to offer to install QuickTime from Apple Software Updater.
I mean, it happens. I mean, it's not... I mean, it's good that we're seeing it in the news, that, like, people are realizing, I guess, that it's an issue, that, you know, software that's not being updated is still being pushed out like that. But, I mean, it's hardly... you know, a singular incident. I mean, I see more Windows XP systems in a big business these days than I probably should. You know, it'll be stuff like it's embedded in a manufacturing device, so it would have cost them $2 million to replace it or something like that. Like, legitimate business reasons why they still have it, as opposed to, you know, we just forgot about it kind of stuff that, I mean... you're going to
right.
have things like this. I think, I mean, at the very least, you know, it's a client-side software, so as long as, you know, you're careful about what kind of files you play with it. I mean, it's not like just by being there, it's going to be, like, remotely accessible like you often do see with things like Windows XP, where you actually have remote vulnerabilities that the machine's just being on, you can attack them, so... But, I mean, it. Like I said, I think it's good that it's in the news, you know, that if I can Google QuickTime vulnerability and it's got, you know, 400,000 results coming up. I mean, that's not something we would have seen as early as, or as late even as just a few years ago. That wouldn't be mainstream news at all. So I think the fact that, you know, the world at large is thinking about these security things, I mean, I as a security person, I, you know, I'm not that old. I haven't been doing this that long. And just in the time since I started security to now, that just people who aren't in any technical field at all, just being the kinds of conversations I'm able to have with, you know, just about anybody, young or old, technical, non-technical. I mean, they're varying degrees of technical, but I think a lot of people are thinking about stuff like this. Like, people know what a security update is, people know what, you know, cryptography is, people know, like, why you don't want to use the same password everywhere. And I think, I mean, that's a major step forward, because it's always, everybody always harks on the users, but, you know, the user shouldn't have to be really technically sophisticated to do this. So we are, I think, seeing a lot of leaps and bounds forwards with this sort of stuff.
And I think we'll definitely cover this part a little bit later, but people actually seem to care more about their privacy now. They've lost a lot of the faith that they have in the parties they deal with in terms of trusting them to secure their data, secure their information. And now people are definitely taking a more active stance with that regard. The two biggest things that I've noticed from the conversation that I want to point out with XP, with a podcast that's coming after this that we recorded before this one with Matthew Eliason, we talk about Windows XP being in the top three operating systems still. That's alarming. That's very alarming. He and I know each other from the military. The Navy is still using Windows XP on surface ships. That's
probably the same sort of situation. It's embedded like in that big, I assume, like space station-y looking thing like they have in the front of the plane, you know? It's expensive to replace it. It's not like buy a new laptop. Windows XP was a
exactly.
good operating system. I don't necessarily know that Microsoft has done that well again. Like, 7 was pretty good, 10 is pretty good, 8 and Vista were disasters. I mean, these are universal truths, but I mean, Windows XP
Right.
was a good operating system. My father refuses to give it up. Like, weird in terms of security, this man. Like, you know, he's a physicist, so he's smart, but he's not into security. But he thinks he's into security because he, you know, has read some articles online, probably the same articles like these about QuickTime. So he's like, I won't put the printer on the network because there might be hackers. Oh no. But he still uses Windows XP. So I try and explain to him, like, you know, the likelihood of your, like, home printer getting hacked and it actually causing you major problems are much smaller than, you know, you're opening a malicious file that you downloaded from the internet on your Windows XP system, but, you know, it doesn't sink in.
Right. I think two of the biggest concerns that go along with this, not necessarily with QuickTime, but with the whole explosion of mainstream media attention for cybersecurity would be the, obviously within the phishing and social engineering realm, it's becoming a bigger and bigger concern because you've got people phishing vice presidents of accounting and CFOs purporting to be the CEO getting W-2 data. And then, you know, of course, just doing it to deliver payloads for malware to set up that interpreter session or what have you. The other one, the biggest question I have is, while I applaud Apple for how they did it, why could this have not been Adobe and why could this have not been Flash?
Well, it could be, I guess. Oh, you mean you just hate those and want to see them go away?
A good indication of insecurity in the computer world away from smartphones, keeping in mind that, you know, your topic is mobile insecurity, is the use of Flash. Flash is inherently insecure, and with it, there's very little mitigation, and honestly, it just needs to go away. No one really supports it anymore. But for whatever reason, it just keeps chugging right along. But useful things like Safari and QuickTime go away and Flash just sticks around.
Well, I mean, I like to think of things like that. Well, like WebKit in particular on mobile, I kind of, you know, cheekily call it like a bunch of used after free bugs that somehow renders pages. Flash and things like that, JavaScript. I mean, a lot of those are, you know, kind of in the same boat that particularly like dynamic rendering, if you will, it really is just a bunch of use after free bugs. So, I mean, I can see your point that why not get rid of something like Flash? I don't know. Probably a lot like Windows XP. There's probably a lot of like Flash movies and certain places that they just haven't gotten off of it yet. I remember when Flash movies were like the coolest thing in the world, so I don't know.
So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to discuss mobile insecurity. Stick around. We'll be back.
Are you looking for a place to advertise to the unique audience of IT security professionals and enthusiasts? Look no further. Advanced Persistent Security is seeking sponsors. This slot could be yours. Contact sales at advancedpersistentsecurity.net for more information.
Thank you for sticking around through the break. I continue to be Joe Gray, and with me is Georgia Viedman. We're going to cut into the meat and potatoes of this podcast today with the topic of mobile insecurity. Georgia, the floor is yours.
All right. Well, mobile insecurity is like the name of the talk I give sometimes. I should really come up with a more like clever talk title, but nonetheless. So I guess I kind of talk about all the things that are wrong with mobile, but I shouldn't like harp on mobile as being so bad. In a lot of ways, like a lot of the problem with mobile is it's just secure enough that everything that we did to make, you know, our PCs and the environment where we had, you know, our personal computers, all the things that we had done to take that and make it not secure per se, but like secure enough to not be a complete disaster. Like, a lot of those don't apply really well to mobile. I think, like, you know, antivirus is one that I always use as an example. You know, antivirus always gets a lot of, like, really bad press. People think that antivirus is just basically a piece of shit, if you will, pardon my French. But, I mean, it's really not. I mean, antivirus provides a very specific service. Antivirus searches for known malware samples, the keyword being known. And where antivirus gets a lot of flack is that it's not finding unknown virus samples, and that's not what it does. It has no mechanism, by and large, the antivirus industry. I mean, sure, there's, you know, we get back to next gen with air quotes that you can't see right now. You know, you get next gen stuff that, you know, tries to dynamically find things. I mean, there's certainly, you know, a big industry doing that sort of stuff, but your, you know, vanilla antivirus does nothing for that. It specifically scans files on your file system and says, you look like a virus because you have a hash that's the same as this virus I know about. And there are absolutely ways to get your viruses around that. Absolutely, you can do all kinds of encodings and things, make them polymorphic, and they don't show up anymore. But again, that's not what the antivirus is doing. So, given that antivirus only does a specific thing, antivirus vendors is like, oh, mobile devices, let's go make some more money, as they should. You know, we're companies, we want to make money, we want to sell products. So we put the word mobile in front of our antivirus, and then we sell them onto all the mobile devices, Android, iOS, what have you. We have mobile antivirus. But the trouble is, really, that the mobile devices are just a little bit too secure. Not that the mobile devices don't get viruses, of course they do. There's mobile malware all over the place. Yes, even on you, iOS, even on you. And the mobile antivirus is doing the same sort of thing. It scans the files to look for known samples. The trouble is that, you know, even on Android, Android's kind of, you know, the low bar, the problem child of mobile is Android. But even Android's, you know, it's doing a lot of things right. So, like, each application has its own sandbox, if you will, in Android. So it kind of lives in its own place where only it has permissions. Now, it's Linux-based, so, you know, you can do that. Everybody's a file and everybody is a user. So your mobile antivirus is just a user. You know, it's an application that someone installs on there. So it can scan its own files and any files that are specifically shared with it, but just, you know, your run-of-the-mill, like, malware application need only install itself and then, after installation, start pulling down malicious files and exploits and things to spy on you. And the mobile antivirus can't scan those files. So it doesn't really work in the mobile landscape. And yet, you know, antivirus companies are making untold dollars out of this. And they get away with this because they can. They're antivirus. And, you know, they've provided their specific value that does, in my mind, provide value in the computer world where it can look at the file system and say, that's bad, go away. So it provides a value. Is it like the smoking gun of security? Absolutely not. But then when you take it over to the mobile side, it isn't really, you know, in my mind, providing much at all because it can't see enough in order to provide value. So it, like, either needs to be baked into the operating system itself and, you know, run as root, if you will, or we need to do something else. There needs to be something else in the place of looking for, you made a nasty on your computer kind of thing. So I think we see that a lot with our mobile devices. I think we see a lot of this kind of worked, or it provided a particular security function in our old world of, you know, workstation servers, Active Directory, mail servers, so on and so forth. So in that environment, this thing we had provided value, so we're just sticking the word mobile on it and moving it over. And I don't think we've put enough time into thinking about, like, what we really need in the mobile world, for one, and two, whether these things are really providing us value. I think that, you know, we just kind of tried to retrofit everything. I think, You know, a good way to think about it is like when the first firewalls came out, and you know, if you want to get some interesting like blast from the past kind of talks, like look up like Marcus Raynham stuff when he's like first, you know, quote unquote inventing like firewalls, and then same thing with like intrusion detection systems. I mean, it just the idea that it was so astounding that you would just like not let traffic go to a port under certain circumstances, and that was just so astounding at the time, right? But I mean, the early firewalls and intrusion detection systems were really not that sophisticated. I mean, if you do like certified ethical hacker or any of those like, you know, early stage certifications where, you know, you learn material and you know, do a test, CISSP, all those, I mean, that's, you know, the entry level certification before you start doing the hands on stuff. You see a lot of stuff like, you know, Christmas tree scan and stuff like that, that it's like, you know, you light up all the bits on your packet and it walks through the firewall. And it's, you know, today in 2016, this is like, what? Because it's like, why would that ever work? And it's like stuff like that worked against the firewall because much like I just said about the antivirus, it was matching. And I mean, still does to a certain extent, just matches specific packets. So if it doesn't meet the requirement of the match, it would go through it. So it was hackers, it was people like us, penetration testers, before there was a word penetration tester, who were realizing this and getting the firewalls fixed. And if you've ever had to go up against these next gen firewalls, I mean, this industry has gone a long way since like the Christmas tree scan. I mean, these things are pretty fancy. They've got a lot of capabilities. They're basically like a behemoth. And they do a lot of stuff. They do some stuff well, they do some stuff less well, but in general, it's been brought up around like the needs of an enterprise's security, and it's fixed issues that penetration testers and ethical hackers have found over the years to make them more sophisticated. So we basically made the next-gen firewall. And I haven't seen that around mobile. You know, mobile's been around for a while. Mobile's been in the enterprise for a while now. We've been calling it the next big thing for a really long time, and I just haven't seen the same level of maturity. I feel like we just kind of throw things at the dartboard and say, this is security now. And a lot of times who you would think would be really sophisticated CISOs, you know, and they are. They're the kind of CISOs that I really enjoy working with, the ones that have, you know, been in the trenches, who know the security thing and are really interested in keeping their enterprise secure. But then they say things like, oh, we have sandboxing because we use Office 365. And it's like, I'm pretty sure Office 365 doesn't have a sandboxing feature. Like, well, it kind of maybe implies in the box that it sandboxes, but it definitely doesn't sandbox, and, you know, neither does it make a huge claim that it does. But, I mean, it's really hard to be able to say, like, what your security posture is without having, you know, anything, any baseline to put it up against, any way to test it, and even really an idea of like what the risks are. I think, you know, you get, oh, mobile's either the biggest, scariest risk ever, or you get like the Verizon report that's like, oh, it's not a risk at all. But then it's like, oh, are you checking off snort signatures? Well, how many snort signatures are there for mobile exactly? Zero? Oh, wow, no wonder you're not catching anything. But that's neither here nor there, I guess. So, you know, I should not just carry on in this monologue this way. I should, you know, allow you to ask me some questions maybe before I do the whole talk right here on the radio.
Sure. And you mentioning the AV. I talked to a sales guy the other day about something completely different. It had nothing to do with mobile. But he tried to sell me a product. I'm not going to say which product or who it was that tried to sell it to me. But I'm going to mention three products. I'm going to get your opinion on whether you think they would actually be a viable solution for mobile. The first is called Cylance. The second is called Carbon Black. And the third one is called Sentinel One. You may recognize the name Sentinel One because that, when Netflix made headlines for quote unquote discontinuing the use of antivirus, that's what they went to. What all three of these products are, they're marketed as next generation malware protection. Do you think that might actually have a place in the mobile environment?
Well, you know, I don't want to, like, endorse or unendorse this particular product, and I kind of, I guess, kind of segued into that it's, like, there is certainly, this is a huge, like, buzzwordy kind of market now, the, like, next-gen malware. I think we've had, like, two or three companies come through Mach 37 doing it. I mean, it's these kinds of things that are, like, really hard to do well, but if they are done well, maybe make a really big difference, I think we're seeing a lot of stuff like that, not just in, like, the quote-unquote next-gen malware, but I guess the next-gen a lot of things. But, I mean, it's really hard. If you think about it, it's like, what does malware, by and large, do? You know, it accesses files, and it sends data to the internet, or, it records something, and then maybe saves it to a file. And then you think about, you know, programs that are doing legitimate things, and what do? Well, they write to files, and they call out to the internet and send data. So, I mean, it's a very difficult problem, like the malware heuristics, and like trying to be able to say in a programmatic way what's bad and what's good. So, I mean, it's certainly a very difficult problem to answer. You're very much at risk of getting a lot of false negatives and a lot of false positives, which are both, you know, very annoying. I mean, we saw, like, you know, it's old news, but Neiman Marcus had all those alerts, and they just had so many that people were ignoring them. So, I mean, I definitely see there being value in these next-gen kind of products, both, you know, on mobile as well as, you know, in your traditional computing world, like, you know, Netflix using this, like, in their workstations and their servers, things like that. I mean, I definitely see value in it. It kind of comes in the same kind of thing I was talking about mobile, that, I mean, we kind of go on faith about these things. It's like, you think about what security products you're buying and why are you buying them? Are you buying them because they're good? And if you're buying them because they're good, how do you know? Did you, like, do a bake-off and make malware and put it up against those three products and see which one found it? Or did you just kind of go off what, you know, other people were using? Did you ask, like, your friends at the CISO meeting? Did the sales guy just do a better job? I mean, did you hear about it at a conference? And I think, you know, it's really hard to make the right decisions, even for somebody who is pretty sophisticated technically. And, you know, as someone who has a big budget, you know, people are going to be clamoring to give you stuff to try, you know, the kind of stuff that, you know, I would, you know, just do just about anything, give up, like, you know, my left hand to get my hands on some of these $1 million boxes. You know, they'd just be given to you. But I think it's really hard to say, like, I did a radio interview, like, with this federal news radio, and the guy called it, he said it in Latin, which is a lot more sophisticated than me. It was like, who watches the watchmen? Like, these security products, like, I could go out and make a security product right now, and it could be malware. And we've seen instances of this, no less, you know? So it's like, who makes these products good? I mean, like, we've seen some security vendors go belly up, basically, for, you know, bad practices. We've seen, you know, people have poor security hygiene with their customer data. We've seen, you know, all sorts of things. And certainly security is hard, but, I mean, I think we need some way to be able to put, you know, the sophisticated security testing, if you will, in the hands of, you know, the people who have to secure these enterprises, because, you know, your guy who's out finding O-Days is probably not going to be the CISO at a big company. So we have to get it to the point where the CISOs at these companies can test the effectiveness of their security program. They can see what, like, assuming you are going to get hacked, because we do kind of have to assume that, assuming you're going to get hacked, like, they need to be able to see how well, like, their security program can contain an attack. Like, how are they, what kind of data are they going to lose? How hard is it going to be for them to, like, realize they were attacked? Like, what weird backdoor ways do they have for data to get out? Like, if you have your super ultra platinum next gen firewall, but you allow mobile devices on the same network as your sensitive data, like, can the mobile devices send data out through the mobile modem? It doesn't hit the next gen firewall, so no wonder it didn't see it because it was never there, kind of thing. So, I mean, being able to, like, really test these scenarios, short of, like, having to bring in, like, a really sophisticated red team that, you know, we hackers are notorious for being too expensive. I think, you know, the Apple versus FBI totally failed to, like, run this with this story that it's like, why does the FBI not have hackers that can do this kind of thing? It's like, because we want too much. We want people to do our laundry and a gym membership and to work from home and all this stuff that, like, the Googles of the world give you, but the government just can't keep up with that. You know, it's
right.
Being able to do this without having to have 10, like, A-list hackers on your staff has got to be made possible if we're going to make it. So, yeah.
Well, with the FBI, I think the inability to have blue hair, and with us recording this on 4/21, which would be National Surprise Drug Test Day, the FBI not allowing partaking in yesterday's celebrations, I think may have a lot to do with that as well.
Oh, definitely. I'm sure it does. I was talking to a lawyer friend of mine, and it was like, you know, at most government agencies, you can have smoked pot in the past as long as you don't do it again, in air quotes. But, like, the FBI, it's like you can't have done it 7 times or something. And then, of course, my reaction to that, you know, being a child of the 90s, like, are you telling me Fox Mulder smoked pot only 7 times? Yeah, X-Files. So, yeah.
Exactly. And a lot of what you were saying really, really started to resonate with regards to, while not mobile, more into the ransomware world. Do you see ransomware making its way to the mobile ecosystem?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's, I think that, I mean, a lot of things, I read something about this a couple of years ago that is like an economic viewpoint of why we see more, like, I guess, old malwares, if you will, like, you know, malware that's targeting XP, if you will, versus, like, malware that's targeting mobile and some of the newer stuff, just that, I mean, like you say, like, in terms of actual hosts out there, you know, if you're getting $1 a piece, you want to go for the stuff that has, like, the widest adoption, and obviously that's the easiest to attack. So I think, you know, as we see more and more of these devices, we're definitely going to see more and more, like, malware and ransomware in that space. I mean, I think, you know, the mobile device primarily is just, like, one person, whereas if you get a hospital, you've got, like, a bigger target base. But, I mean, particularly, like, with the smaller, like, targeted attacks, like, you'll see, like, the high net worth individuals, the kind of people who are, like, taking classes on how, like, not to get hacked, like, even as an individual, because they have so much to lose. Like, you could definitely see, like, targeted ransomware against their personal devices. Probably you're already seeing that in some cases.
Do you see mobile devices being carriers for ransomware for cars? In other words, they carry the payload, but it doesn't do anything to the mobile device until it connects to a car via USB or Bluetooth.
Yeah, absolutely. Something like that. Or, I mean, we've seen in the past, like air-gapped cleared networks have gotten malware infections because someone phone was running out of battery, so they USB plugged it in to, you know, an air gap network and infected it. I mean, we've certainly seen instances of, you know, the phone gets an infection, and, you know, the second gen payload is that when it attaches to other devices, it infects, like, it has a Windows payload or it has a Mac payload, and it infects it that way. So certainly, as it is attaching to more devices, that's certainly other options as well. I mean, every time it, I mean, I've seen things where it like attaches to a toilet. So, you know, this Internet of Things thing is definitely getting out of hand. Like, why do you need to put your toilet on the internet? I don't understand. But I mean, the people who are in the industry, you know, they're like, oh, but then like the lights can turn themselves to a certain brightness based on who's sitting there. And I'm like, can't you get a clapper? But, you know, then they've got things that, you know, it can prevent cancer. So they get their money.
I've been listening to a lot of other podcasts lately, like Paul's Security Weekly, Southern Fried Security Podcast, Defensive Security Podcast, amongst others. And Internet of Things has been just a huge topic with all of them. But as of late, ransomware has kind of been picking up as well. Mobile, there's nothing big that's really making those headlines, that's really driving the FUD, if you will, the fear, uncertainty, and doubt to really, you know, do that. But do you see a cataclysmic event, so to speak, in the mobile ecosystem that's going to create that kind of publicity in the next, say, 1 to 2 years?
I mean, I see probably like, you know, 2 or 3 possibilities, but I mean, it's, the media is an interesting bird. It's interesting what gets kind of, I think this Apple versus FBI thing is kind of, you know, the people they send out to get killed first, the vanguard, that, you know, people are starting to think about mobile as kind of more insecure than they realize, which is good. I like to see people, like, thinking about these things that way. So, I mean, it's certainly, I mean, a lot of the trouble with it is that we're not doing a lot of detection around mobile. I mean, I kind of made the joke that it's like, oh, so you put out a report of all the things you detected and there's no attacks in mobile. How many attacks for mobile were you looking for exactly? Oh, no wonder you found none. So I think that, I mean, a lot of why we don't see a lot of scary in those areas, be it mobile, be it Internet of Things, be it, you know, anything like that, is mainly because we're not really looking. I mean, our detection capabilities, like our security capabilities, are behind. You know, they're kind of slapping the word mobile on it, but then not really providing anything like mobile-based or Internet of Things-based. So, you know, if it doesn't look like the original attack traffic it's used to seeing, which, you know, in a lot of cases it probably doesn't look the same, you're gonna not be able to find it with the original snort rules, etc. So, I mean, certainly I think there are going to be stories worth being big stories in these mobile Internet of Things, all these, you know, new buzzword categories. It's just a matter of, like, what gets picked up on in the media, really.
It's what can make the best story, right?
Yeah.
In terms of applications for mobile devices, are you a fan of, say, content blockers?
Just in
principle, not necessarily a specific one, just the principle behind them. Do you think they serve a purpose in the prevention of, say, malicious code or other malware on the mobile devices from, say, unvetted ad sources?
I mean, I think there's certainly value to it. I think that as long as people don't kind of see it as a panacea, even in, like, in that specific, like, you know, if I use this, I'll never get ad-based malware ever, then it's a good thing. I mean, as long as, you know, people are realizing that, you know, it comes with, I mean, you still need to do the security awareness, you still need to do your antiviruses and next-gen antiviruses, that, I mean, it needs to be part of a bigger program. And I think, I mean, the real trouble comes in when you've got, like, a vendor that, you know, provides a content blocker as part of, like, a bigger package, and then you say, okay, my security problems are taken care of by vendor X, you know, I've got their set of tools around mobile or around Internet of Things or around Windows domains or around whatever. And so now my security problem is taken care of and I don't have to think about it anymore. I think that's, I mean, though, it seems like a step in the right direction, being able to say, I have my security problems taken care of now. I think it, you know, if you will, gives you a false sense of security. So I think, I mean, anything that's providing, like, a value like that, anything that blocks one malware attack is something that I would certainly never tell people not to buy it, you know? But I think, I mean, it's, the issue is not, like, blocking the one attack. It's about, you know, the whole variety of attacks that we're going to get to. I mean, there's somebody in our Mach 37 cohort right now, Mach 37 being the security accelerator for product businesses I went through, that's working with, like, physical security, like tailgating and stuff like that. And it's like, you know, originally I was skeptical, but it's like, you know, that's a really big problem. So, you know, your content blocker can't fix that. So you really have to think of it in terms of, like, the bigger picture. So, you know, you don't want to, whatever it is about not seeing the forest for the trees kinds of things with security. I mean, I don't know that we got it the first time around if we were recording, like, when I said security is hard, because it is. And it's like, I think, I mean, the main thing is not to see a solution as, like, too good to be true that, you know, if something says it fixes your security problem now, that's probably your first indication that it's not as good as it says it is.
That reminds me, in talking about those podcasts that I've been listening to lately, I remember right after RSA, one of them came back and was laughing because there was a vendor selling a solution, and the solution solved the following problem. The problem was advanced next generation APT.
Well, that's great and all, but what about my, like, really basic, this generation, basic, unpersistent threat? Like, what if that gets in? What good did that just do? I mean, I think that...
Well, that part doesn't matter, because the solution they were selling was for advanced, next generation advanced. It was double advanced persistent threat, and it was next generation. So...
Buzzwords are cool, yo.
Yeah. Well, I had to drop that joke in there, but I mean, you're absolutely correct with this regard. It's just a matter of sometimes the most simplistic solution is the best solution. In the other podcast, the one that's going to air after this about ransomware, one of the things we were talking about was a vector being social engineering and phishing. And one of the services that Advanced Persistent Security offers is social engineering and phishing awareness training.
Oh, we should talk.
We can, off channel. But we're not trying to recreate the phishmies of the world or phishing as a service. What we're doing is we want to customize user training, because our thought process is the fact that no amount of money you throw at technology will solve the social engineering problem. You can put a Bayesian filter in line with your email. You can, you know, get multiple platforms, multiple vendor advanced next generation firewalls. You could get Fortinet, FireEye, Palo Alto, all the above. You could employ every level of defense in depth, but at the end of the day, social engineering, being non-technical in nature, will reign supreme. So, I mean, that's why, you know, to really hammer home on the point you're making, technology is not always the right answer either. It has to be a culture of some sort.
Oh, absolutely. I think that, and we see in a lot of the big breaches that we see that it's something like physical access or social engineering or, like, you know, a patch that should have been applied 8 years ago, that it's like, I mean, on the one hand, it's like we're not seeing a lot of the really sophisticated attacks that are probably happening just because, like I said, we don't have, you know, detection checks for them yet, so we can't see them. But also because things like, I mean, why would you go through all the trouble to, like, either spend $1 million or, you know, spend 1 million hours on your ODAI and your really sophisticated advanced persistent threat when the, you know, fire up Metasploit and read my book, and you'll probably get into most places, let's be honest.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you have to look at it as a bigger picture, because it's, you got to do the hard stuff, but you can't miss the easy stuff, because that's the stuff that will get you.
Right. Especially, like, with companies that's dropping all these, all this money, you know, they're spending multiple multi-million dollar, you know, contracts on buying ultra sophisticated security equipment. I mean, that's fine. That works really well against most nation states and even your more advanced hackers. But what it doesn't work against would be, you know, rogue users, the insider threat, and social engineers. So a pen tester that actually employs social engineering techniques in the pen test, or, you know, lo and behold, someone doing it with malice that is phishing, you know, all that money means nothing. Investing in your people, because technology at some point will fail with that regard. It will fail to solve the problem, but at the same time, technology really doesn't fail either. Let's go ahead and wrap this particular section up. We'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we will do a quick banter about Apple versus the FBI, since we're talking about mobile devices. So sit tight.
Are you subscribed to this podcast? If not, please do so on iTunes and at advancedpersistentsecurity.net/podcast.
Thank you for sticking around through the break. I am, yet again, still Joe Gray, and with me still is Georgia Wiedemann. We are now going to talk about Apple versus the FBI. So, as many of you know, if you have basically not lived under a rock in the year 2016, you know of a heinous act of terrorism that occurred in San Bernardino County, California. And with regards to it, the terrorist had an Apple iPhone 5C, of which during the investigation, the FBI recovered, but the device was locked and it was set to do a wipe if the password was input too many times incorrectly. So the FBI ultimately commissioned Apple under the All Writs Act of 1789 to aid them in getting into the phone. Initially, they wanted Apple to write a backdoor that they could use, but Apple refused, citing the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, stating that they had no assurance of misuse and that they were willing to help any other way. Georgia, do you believe that's a pretty good summation of the initial brooding storm of Apple versus the FBI?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's a kind of taken on a life of its own. Well, kind of is not even like the right word for it. It really has, like, you know, you could probably sit on the street and ask people and everyone would have an opinion on this, whereas it's, you know, it's like security story, really, but, you know, it's a security story that's, you know, on the order of Snowden in terms of, you know, how much of a wide, like, market it's gotten.
It's definitely getting a lot of steam for the EFF, that's for sure.
Yeah.
With regards to the Apple versus the FBI, do you think that this was part of a bigger agenda or just trying to solve a crime?
I think it's definitely part of a bigger agenda. It's, the idea that this doesn't happen, you know, that governments don't get zero-day exploits or other workarounds to get around, you know, fully patched latest security updates of products, it's just absurd. I mean, they must. Of course they do. That's how the whole, like, you know, black market for exploits is done. I guess what we don't like to hear particularly is that, you know, it would be just against one of your own citizens and targeted against one citizen. I mean, this particular person, you know, one was already dead and two, you know, had committed an act of terrorism, but what's to stop the FBI or, you know, local law enforcement and some little town from using something like this that's been shared with them against, like, you know, a routine traffic stop. I think that, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we worry about. I mean, certainly in the security industry, we realize that it would be really naive to think that the governments don't use zero-day exploits, but I guess we more like to think about them using them on other governments rather than, you know, against their own citizens. But, I mean, it's certainly always going to be possible. I think that, you know, we see this, you know, happen in things like penetration testing or exploit development, and we have to realize that, you know, with the good comes the bad. The bad guys are using it. The good guys are using it. But, I mean, all we can do is try and make the state of the art and security higher, knowing that it's never going to be good enough, knowing that there's always going to be a way in. That, I guess, the quote that people always use, I need to stop saying it, because every time I say it in a news interview, that's like the only part of the interview they take, where I say that the only secure device is one that's turned off, melted down, and buried. Like, they took that on World News Tonight on ABC, and it's been in a couple other ones. So if I just stop saying that, I'll get another news bite besides that one. But, I mean, there's always going to be vulnerabilities. There's always going to be vulnerabilities that, I mean, I think that as security people, we weren't too surprised by all this, really. But it's taken the masses by storm, if you will.
I will definitely put both of those in block quotes, just so that you can perpetuate that your melted down quote, just to keep it alive.
Okay.
Yeah, like you said, when people traditionally think of their government hacking another government, they think of things like Stuxnet. They think of going after the bad guys, you know, going after ISIS, not necessarily going after someone that's, you know, a citizen. It's very common here in Georgia. There is a specific police chief that tells his officers, if they pull someone over, to ask that person if they can see their phone to see if they were texting and driving. The chief actually admitted that he knows that it's not that if someone says, no, you can't look, there's nothing else that can be done. But he said there's nothing preventing his cops from asking either.
Right, and I think there has been some, like, push to try and make laws about it, and like making tools that make it easy enough, you know, for the investigator to like take a phone and get like the backlog, which, you know, for us people who do security tools, that would be nothing. It's like, you know, you saw the story about how the TSA spent all that money on the like pseudo random number generator that said left or right, and it's like, who gets to write the thing for the cops to like pull your text message history and like charge $1 million for it? Where do I get that job? Because
right.
I could write it in like an hour.
Right. Or, you know, I know a good stingray dealer.
Yeah.
Purely kidding. I don't even want to go down the rabbit hole of stingrays. But nonetheless, I mean, the director of the FBI had actually been, he stated on the record while testifying to Congress that he's been heavily lobbying for crypto systems used in the United States to have a mandatory backdoor. So I think this was part of a significantly bigger agenda. And I know that a couple senators now have actually written a bill proposing that, but it's going over like a lead balloon. Even the White House is saying no. No, this is ridiculous. So at what point, you know, at what point do we sacrifice personal freedom for the purpose of cracking the code to get into a phone?
I mean, I think it's interesting that, I mean, if you think about it in terms of before technology, like if you were going to commit a crime and you were really sophisticated about covering your tracks, I mean, even if you were going to be dead after whatever, for the sake of your children's inheritance or whatever, you covered your tracks about it, and, you know, you put your plans or your communications with other people who were also terrorists or whatever, you put them in like a locked drawer that was booby-trapped to like blow up when it was opened or something, and then when the cops came, it blew up because they opened it. I mean, that would be it. It would be gone. and someone took the time to, you know, set all that up, particularly, you know, in an earlier time where that was harder to do, it took some sophistication, and that would be that. And I think that, I mean, the difference here is that, you know, when you set up the iPhone and it's not supposed to be hard, you don't have to be technical, you like hit next, it sets up, you know, a pretty good standard of security for you just right there. So you don't have to work very hard to give yourself a certain level of security that it's like, you know, it's much better per se than just like the lock that comes on your door. You know, it's like the people with the deadbolts and the massive locks and things, the people who are taking their security very seriously, you know, that level of security analogy is available to anybody who buys an iPhone. And I can see why that's kind of annoying to the people who are in the business of you not being secure.
Right. But at the same time, you know, I hear a lot of people say, I've got nothing to hide. It's like, well, it doesn't matter if you have nothing to hide. You have some reasonable expectation to some level of privacy.
Well, I was surprised, really, I guess, like when the Snowden stuff came out even. And I feel like, you know, this is just the next wave in that, that, you know, when that came out and everybody was so outraged at the idea that people are spying on you. And it's like, have you not heard of Google? Like when you're signed into Gmail and then it like watches everything you do. I mean, I felt like, you know, I was wrong about how desensitized the public at large had become to that. I really didn't expect that there was going to be such an outcry against it, because I feel like, you know, we've taken so many steps down that it really wasn't that big of a stretch for the government to be spying on us. I mean, we know Google and Facebook are. What's the difference? But, you know, I was wrong. You know, as a security person, as somebody who's really technical, of course, you know, I see all these things all the time. I realize I'm being spied on all the time. But I really thought the world at large did too, but I guess not.
Right. Well, I mean, I think a lot of that's evidenced by the number of people who copied and pasted the privacy statement onto their Facebook page, despite reading the terms and conditions saying that it's your stuff, but you grant an open-ended permanent license for Facebook to use it as they please as well.
Yeah. I mean, that's life. Like you can't not use it. Like I don't check my Facebook messages and I've missed all these like things about podcasts or things about like conferences people want me to go to, or heaven forbid it's a client. You know, I don't know why people can't just use email, but this is how it works these days. LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, all these things. That's like how business is done. And
right.
Somebody's watching. Well, that's not the whole point.
Well, I mean, you know, truth be told, when I contacted you through a platform of the same sort as well, because honestly, I could have found your email address, but the thing about email addresses and the reason why some people don't use them, in my opinion, is that, you know, they don't know, does this person check the email? Does this person have an assistant that's going to screen the email? Will it even get through? Will I hit a spam filter, or will it, you know, or will it just become just another email and get ignored?
And you think, like, being one of, like, 256 LinkedIn messages I got that day isn't going to be in the same boat?
Well, I mean, LinkedIn's at least quasi-professional.
Yeah, well, I set up LinkedIn to forward to my email, so I'm not going to miss any more LinkedIn messages. But just today, somebody, like, contacted one of my friends to say that I had not answered his Facebook message. And I'm like, you know how many Facebook messages I get that are, like, spam or somebody trying to sell me something or somebody, you know, who doesn't even speak English?
Oh, yeah.
Every single day. It's hard, you know, it's hard to do business in this, and this has gotten off the track of the Apple versus FBI, but it's still within privacy. It is. It's all so interconnected. The idea that a terrorist supposedly had his plans for his terrorism on his iPhone at all is a sign of the time we live in.
Well, I mean, he could have been syncing it to iCloud. Use it. He might have had a Mac computer at home and synced it to his iCloud, or he could have even did iCloud from Windows. He could have a Dropbox account on there. He could have, you know, Google Drive. He could have any sort of cloud provider. But the reality of it is,
well, then,
you know,
they should go talk to those vendors.
Well, they should. And I mean, without getting deep into it, you know, Reddit just changed their privacy, you know, their warrant canary. I don't want to really get down into that rabbit hole because it has absolutely nothing to do with Apple versus the FBI, but, you know, that definitely shows the world we live in terms of privacy.
Well, you know, I would love to be in the position that my company was so big that the government was showing up trying to, like, put pressure on me to, like, give up the privacy stuff. I mean, that would be the sign that I had arrived in terms of,
exactly.
like, big company. Like, yeah.
Actually, I think in my regard, my company making it would be when the Department of Defense forces everyone to install my stuff on their computers or in their networks.
Yeah, I could live with that.
Yeah.
It's interesting, like, having gone through, like, quasi-business school, like, just, you know, if you can latch on to something where, like, people have to use your stuff or it, like, gets installed with somebody else's stuff, and that's, like, you know, that's quote-unquote traction.
Yeah. I mean, dominate your vertical. But with that being said, we're going to go ahead and wrap up the Apple versus the FBI portion. Just know to come to advancedpersistentsecurity.net and take a look at our multiple blogs discussing Apple versus the FBI. You can search using the tag Apple versus FBI. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to wrap up the show. George is going to give you some parting advice, tell you how to contact her, and then we will move on. Sit tight.
Don't forget to check out our blog at advancedpersistentsecurity.net/blog. Follow us on Twitter at @ADVPersistentSEC and follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/advancedpersistentsecurity.
Thank you for sticking around through the break. I'm not going to go through the trouble of telling you who I am, but we're going to wrap up the show and take it from there. So it's definitely been fun. It's been real. Thank you for being my first guest external to Advanced Persistent Security on the podcast.
No way. You didn't tell me that going into it.
Exactly. I'll tell you some other people that's agreed to be on it after the fact.
Okay.
I think we had a really good discussion talking about current events, talking about QuickTime that morphed into a discussion about Windows XP, and then we kind of got down the social engineering and phishing rabbit hole, ransomware. It was an excellent discussion about mobile insecurity and the problems we face. I really wish I would have thought to mention something more about mobile device management, but that could be another talk for another day.
Well, I mean, mobile device management or enterprise mobility management or whatever you want to call it these days was kind of what I meant by, like, the overarching security solution. So we kind of talked about it. We just didn't name it.
Right. Well, we could always work on coming up with an advanced next-generation cell phone intrusion detection system.
Somebody needs to. But I mean, the fact that I'm the first external guest makes me feel a little less bad about how long it took me to, like, find time that we could both do this.
Yeah, I had no benchmark. But, you know, we also talked about Apple versus the FBI, and now we're here at the wrap-up portion. So provide some parting advice that you may have for the listeners, and then let us know how to contact you, where to find you, any special offers or promotions you may have.
Okay, so parting advice. So if you want to be a hacker, pen tester, security professional, well, read my book, but that's another story. What I really don't like about the whole security scene is that it's a lot about, like, who you know, and, like, you go to conference and you meet people and that's how you get a job, because, you know, 99.9% of the time, you know, they're not going to write you back otherwise in HR, which is really sucky because by and large, you know, we are an industry of, you know, socially inept people. So to get around that, so I'll just assume you're like me and you don't want to go, like, talk to people because that's hard. I would suggest what you should do if you want to break into security is try and do some research. And, you know, research kind of sounds scary, right? It sounds hard. It sounds like what PhD people do. But by and large, it's not necessarily true. I mean, one, the bar, there's so many security conferences and there's not that many people, like, doing security research. So you could say that the bar for security research is somewhat low. So you could probably come up with something that, you know, is new and different that somebody has not been doing. I'm not going to say you're going to, like, go to Black Hat with it necessarily. I mean, that doesn't have to be your, like, first goal. That can be your goal later. But, like, to do, like, a security B-side or another security conference, I mean, the research has to be quality. But I assure you, you know, regardless of where you're at when you start, if you put, like, some time and effort into becoming sophisticated, you know, at a particular topic, I assure you that any of you listeners can become security researchers, can get your work out there. You know, things like, you know, I have a CISSP or a CEH or whatever. I mean, those are, yes, they help, but those aren't really going to differentiate you within a certain set. You know, within a certain set, you already got the certification, so being able to say, you know, I spoke at this conference, or I, you know, published this paper, or I was quoted in this podcast, or, you know, I had, was on this, whatever, you know, having things to differentiate yourself that, you know, go beyond that, that show that you, you know, take the time and the effort to really put in the, gee, the time and the effort to put in the time and the effort. This is going well. Anyway, so that you, you know, go the extra mile, if you will, to get where you need to be. I mean, those are the kinds of things that will have people coming to you, as opposed to, you know, having people not write back to your resume when you make a job posting. So, I mean, short of, like, knowing someone personally, that's the best way, I think, to break into the industry. And like I said, you know, knowing people personally is hard for me. So I imagine it's hard for a lot of you as well. So, you know, that's my how to break into InfoSec. So my other thing would be, so if you're trying to, you know, make things more secure, either for yourself personally or for your company or enterprise or, dare I say it, government agency, I guess we kind of really talked about that for, I guess, the middle portion of the podcast. But, I mean, I think we really need to question, like, what we consider to be secure. I mean, going back to, you know, what I said about breaking into security, like, a lot of the really good security research, the ones that have really changed the status quo, it's been basically taking an assumption and saying, like, what if that's not true? What if what they say is true is not true? Like, you know, probably one of my favorite bugs ever was, you know, a Linux bug where basically it was the thing that loaded drivers, right? So every time you put in, like, a USB or anything like that, it would load up the drivers for that piece of hardware. And for years and years, the Linux driver loader did not actually check to see whether the message that said "load this for me" like came from the kernel. So just by reading, like, the man pages of how to make the right message, you could send it from user space. So as a regular user, I could say "run this for me" and it would run it as root. So it was a great privilege escalation. And nobody noticed this for a really long time because it was just assumed, like, obviously it's not going to let, like, a user run code as root, but it did. So, I mean, so that should give you ideas about the kinds of, you know, research you can do. So, I mean, I want to see us as an industry, not just the researchers, but, you know, people who are, you know, in charge of security, CISOs, like, questioning those things. Like, this says it provides me this security. You know, this says it's a sandbox that is going to protect my files. I wonder how hard it is to get things out. And talk to your users about that, particularly stuff that is security controls that contains what a user is allowed to do on their devices, be it their laptop, be it their phone, you know, your enterprise mobility management. You know, I've gotten my best ideas for breaking out of security controls just talking to users who hate using them. Like, if it makes the PowerPoint look ugly, people are unsophisticated users are going to find ways to get around it even. Like, you don't have to be that technical. Like, if a friend of mine, Jason Street, says this, like, you know, if you want to find how people get around your security measures, take Solitaire off the computer and see how long it takes them to get it back. Like, unsophisticated users will figure it out pretty quick. So that's my advice. You probably weren't expecting 10 minutes of advice, but I do nothing in a short amount of time, as you may have noticed. So,
well, actually, that's perfect advice because, I mean, you know, just to piggyback, for my information security class I teach, I've told the students, you know, the biggest thing I can teach you the fundamentals of security in this class within the confines of a semester, but the biggest thing that you need to learn that I cannot personally teach you is how to have an attitude of how to question the status quo, how to figure out how things work, and how to figure out how to make things work better or different.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I mean, that's a big challenge with my book because it's like I get people who write me and they're like, this particular command doesn't work anymore because the software is updated. And I'm like, one, you know, I want this to be a good book for beginners. I wrote it such that, you know, by and large, they would just be able to follow the text if they wanted to, like, while they're getting the skills there. But, I mean, if you get to the end of it and you still can't, like, debug your way out of it, I mean, no amount of books and tutorials are ever going to be able to teach that to you. And I think, I mean, the people who gave really critical reviews of my book, that's always what they said, like, being able to, like, follow the directions is not going to get you there. And it's like, well, it's a really nice way to start, but I think that, I mean, you do have to, and I struggle with this now, like, doing development stuff, like moving from platform to platform that we support with my product. And it's like, you know, secure Linux is hard. And, you know, I found myself back like reading man pages, how to make secure Linux, let me do what I want to do. And it's like, gee, I feel like a noob again. This sucks. But I mean, that's, you know, the mindset you have to be in if you're going to move forward, because there's, you know, there's always going to be a new security tool, a new, like, memory corruption technique, a new, like, protocol that you're going to hack that, I mean, you're never going to be able to, you know, if you want to continue to advance in this industry, just be able to sit back and be like, I was a great hacker once, so now I'm a great hacker forever.
That kind of reminds me of Mr. Robot. But anyway.
I slept through that show. Like, I watched the first couple episodes, and then I started, like, working on my code, and then my mom watched it with me. She watched it all, but, like, by the end of it, I was asleep. I don't know.
It was kind of hard to watch. I kind of had to fast forward or rewind a few times because I've got a really bad habit of playing on my phone while I'm watching TV. So I would miss, like, critical parts of the show, and I would have to rewind it to figure out what I missed.
Yeah, that's why all my favorite shows are, like, things like reality TV or things that are like, you know, like the procedural shows, like the doctor shows or like Bones or something, where it's like a different, I mean, there's an overarching, like, these are the characters, these are their lives. But, you know, if you work through one of them and then like pick up at the next one, you haven't like completely missed the point.
Right.
Because I work too hard. Like, I watch a lot of TV, honestly, just in the background while I'm working. So I'm not really paying attention to it. But, you know, so I need something that doesn't require my full attention. Luckily, today's, like, by and large, I think today's entertainment helps me out there, that it doesn't really require a lot of attention.
Lots and lots of Terrence and Phillip.
Who's Terrence and Phillip?
They're the cartoon characters that the characters of South Park watch.
See, like, so. When South Park came out, like, it was, like, in that genre like The Simpsons that I wasn't supposed
right.
to watch it because it would give me like bad language and bad ideas about society because I was so young.
Right.
So then I never got into it when I was young. But I imagine I would like it probably.
I liked it because of the amount of vulgar language that was on it and the fact that, you know, it was taboo.
Yeah,
but,
I was definitely not allowed to watch that.
I tried to watch a few episodes as an adult, like, as I was getting out of the Navy around age 25, I was like, this is like the dumbest show. But then I have watched a few episodes, like the ones where they make fun of people like Honey Boo Boo.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I liked Family Guy, like, again, because it was easy to, like, have it on in the background. You know, I'd watch
right.
it, I'd pay attention for 15 minutes and then work for an hour, and it would still be about the same as when I left.
Exactly.
And I was always making fun of like things in pop culture and stuff. That was really funny. All the irreverence of it. It was pretty funny, because it was never like really. It didn't really seem really mean. You know, they kind of made fun of everybody equally.
Exactly. If you're gonna hate, be an equal opportunity hater.
Yeah, but it didn't really feel like hating though. It felt like it was just
oh,
funny.
No.
Like, hating sucks, but it was, I liked it. I don't know.
Okay, so where can the listeners find you?
Well, if you listened through the show, you saw me, like, complain about how many places there are to look for things. So I have forwarded LinkedIn messages to my email. So if you sent me a LinkedIn message in, like, the last 2 years and I didn't write you, it's because I didn't get it because I get so many. But now they're going to my email, so send me another message. Facebook message is still not going anywhere. I get so many of them, I don't know what I'm going to do. So don't message me on Facebook. You can write on my wall on Facebook. But, like, Twitter works, too. I do check the DMs on there. But email is the best way, really. But as I was told in this podcast, email is the thing of the past. So I really need to get with the program with the social media. But Georgia at Bulb Security, so B-U-L-B. Georgia at Shavira, too, but that's harder to spell. So Georgia, they go to the same place. So Georgia at BulbSecurity.com works. And social medias. I try. If you don't hear from me, it's not that I'm a jerk. It's that I probably missed it or I forgot about it. Like, message me again and I'll apologize. So, you know, I get a lot of mail. You know, I try my best. But, you know, I'll try. So if you have a particular question or particular request, I will do my best to help. And if you're looking for a job, it's a little early for us on, you know, hiring people en masse. You know, I promised everyone I've known since, like, birth a job, and we haven't gotten to the end of that list yet. But, you know, if you want to get on the radar now, you know, differentiate yourself. That was the word I was looking for, differentiate. Yeah. So I guess the only thing I have for special offers, like, it's on my Twitter profile even, so it's not particularly special, but you can get a discount on my book at No Starch Press's site. I think it's 30% off with the code Georgia. But, I mean, let's be honest, it's probably still more expensive than it is on Amazon, so probably just go to Amazon. It comes out the same for me. I wanted to have another special offer because some of you may know, I used to do a lot of, like, online training and stuff, and I haven't really done it anymore. I haven't done that much online training in, like, the past year and a half, and I'm actually going to start it back up soon, but in order to do it, we're going to make it really fabulous. So, like, we're building labs and stuff online that are, like, way, way better than Offensive Security and all their labs. Like, we got, not that their labs aren't great, they are, but ours are more, like, unless of, you know, you go in and there's all these boxes and what do? Try harder. It's more like kind of it goes along with the lessons and it helps you through it and stuff like that. So, you know, we're doing labs, we're doing, you know, a lot of pre-recorded stuff and then, like, you know, live stuff as well. But it's not done. You know, of course, we're trying to build a product, grow our pen testing, consulting, as well as, like, basically reboot the training. So it's not like I have a lot going on right now or anything. So I wanted to have, like, a special offer for that, but it's not ready. So maybe, like, when it comes out, I can, like, you know, do an ad in one of the breaks or something and give you guys a special code for it or something. So
you could always do an ad, or you could always come back and tell us about it.
Yeah, we could do that.
And do an ad.
Yeah.
Okay. So, actually, truth be told, I've got an Amazon affiliate link for your book and the in the show notes. I also have links to everything, to Bulb Security and Shavira. I have a link to your email, a link to your Twitter in the show notes as well.
Okay, cool. Then people have ways to contact me. And, you know, I'd love to hear from you guys. I mean, be it, like, somebody breaking into security or, you know, somebody who wants to pilot a security product, we'd love to hear from you. You know, the Security Exchange Commission has a lot of rules about, like, what you're allowed to say publicly about that kind of stuff. But, you know, if you know what I'm talking about when I say the Security Exchange Commission has rules about that sort of stuff, you probably know what I mean, and we'd love to hear from you.
Okay, perfect. So with that being said, I think we're going to wrap this episode up. And it's been definitely a pleasure. Thank you for taking time out of your day to record this and to allow me to mess up recording the first 20 plus minutes of it and then have to start over.
That's totally cool, because like nobody wants to hear like 20 minutes about whether you should go to college early or not. We were probably better to have lost my rant about that.
maybe. But with that being said, goodbye. I will see you next time. And until then, stay secure.
Thank you for listening to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. Until next time, stay secure and don't forget to subscribe to this podcast.